And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
I don't know, there have been so many goals. Like, Harry Kane's goals have just been like a sort of... They've given such a nice feeling of kind of consistency in my life.
Oh.
Just like it's the only thing you can really rely on. There's not a lot you can rely on in life, is there?
But no.
You know Harry Kane is going to score most weekends.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special edition of The View from the Lane, the Tottenham Hotspur podcast from The Athletic. I'm your host, Danny Kelly. And because of what we've got to talk about, there is a full house today to discuss and celebrate not only a gargantuan win over Manchester City, but a really special landmark for one of our own, the great Harry Kane.
Harry Kane! Oh, what a goal! One of their own! A Harry Kane hurricane! Kane past Van Dijk. Can Harry Kane finish here? Oh, you bet he can!
Kane goes for that!
He's gone for it, he's done it! Harry Kane celebrates his 100th goal for Tottenham.
For me, Harry is one of the best strikers on the world. For me, it's too hard to find the word to describe him. I am in love, like the fans are in love, like the teammates are in love. That not only because he scored goals, because how he is professional, humble. He's a very good example in this football today.
On the edge of the box into Kane. Oh!
Harry Kane makes it! Harry Kane makes it 2-1
Nottingham! Played through now to Harry Kane, who's in. What a chance for Harry Kane! Oh, he's taken it! Super finish! He's now Tottenham's all-time leading scorer in European competition.
Højbjerg stepping in.
As you heard there, Harry Kane has broken Jimmy Greaves' long-standing record, become Spurs' all-time top goalscorer with 267 of them. Alongside me on this voyage are The Athletic's James Moore, Jack Pitbrook and Tim Spears. Yes, the full collection because of the enormity of Harry Kane's achievement. But first of all, we should discuss the game because I thought it was massively important. Win for Spurs saved them becoming involved in a fifth-place tussle with Brighton, very much back in the race for the Charlie Eccleshare Shield, a fourth place. Some of you were at the game. What did you make of it, Tim?
I've been waiting for this for quite a few months, I've got to say. Since starting covering this club in September, I've often found a team and also a club and a fan base at times sort of, you know, devoid of passion or purpose. There's been apathy. There's been some dreadful performances. And I was kind of sat there after 80 minutes yesterday and it really just sunk in that this, hang on, right, I get it now. This is it. This is what Spurs are all about. This is the Spurs I've been waiting to see, you know, united on and off the pitch. Might just been for 90 minutes, but it was quite invigorating, really. And that's felt like the Conte team that I've been sort of waiting to see for 90 minutes. That was the noise I've been waiting to hear. And yeah, it was... Everything just came together. It was fantastic. Great day. I hope it's not a one-off.
Best performance this season by miles. First time they've beaten anyone good. First time they've played very well over the whole 90 minutes. It kind of shows how much easier football is if you don't go 2-0 down in the first half. You know, I thought the first half was a perfect bit of game plan in terms of, you know, scoring the goal from that press, just like they did at the Etihad. Second half, I thought, was actually weirdly even better, even though they didn't score, just because, like, on another day, they would have got another three goals, given how good they looked on the break. It might be the best they played under Conte. Obviously, they beat Arsenal, Manchester City in the second half of last season. But they, I didn't think they were amazing in that Arsenal game. They were just very efficient. And in the City game, obviously, they scored right at the very end, which made it much more dramatic. But as a complete performance, I'd say yesterday was better. And also, what really stood out for me was it was a complete team performance, and so many players who've not played well recently were brilliant yesterday. That was the best Emerson Royale's ever played for Spurs. I thought it was Dyer's best game this season. I thought Son looked back to his best. Lots of players who've been copying a lot of shit on Twitter over the last few months were all brilliant yesterday.
So on Sky before the game, they showed like a sort of montage of the previous few matches between Spurs and City in Tottenham. And that kind of served as a reminder of the extent to which Spurs got battered in most of those games. I mean, I'd forgotten, I think this was the 2-0 where Bergwijn scored, where like Lloris came rushing out. Or was that last season maybe? Where Lloris came rushing out and like there was like four clearances off the line. It was absolute chaos. And they easily could have lost that game. You know, there's the penalty in the Champions League game that Lloris saves. There's, you know, endless chances. They were completely under the cosh for the first half of the game last season. But I think that they looked incredibly comfortable throughout during this game. You know, Man City started the better team in the first 10, 15 minutes, and the goal probably was just about against the run of play. But from there, I thought Spurs controlled the game. Won the game on XG, if you care about that sort of thing. Didn't really look in much bother at any point, I didn't think. And, you know, there's been a lot of chat about, you know, on commentary and afterwards about how little of the ball Erling Haaland saw. And if you had your Manchester City hat on, and we obviously will all be putting that hat back on now, you would be worried about that. But I don't think that's just down to how City played. I don't think that's down to how Spurs defended as well, isn't it? I mean, surely you can't. I mean, I'm not saying they don't have problems as a team. They definitely do, City. But I thought it was a very good defensive performance from Spurs.
It was remarkable how little City created. After Mahrez hit the bar at the end of the first half, City never again looked like scoring at all. And it was, I couldn't even think of a moment where City successfully moved Tottenham out of position. You know, obviously the way that City play, or at least before they signed Haaland, is all about, you know, there's quick interchanges and you create the space to exploit with a quick switch or whatever. And there was nothing like that at all. Like Tottenham were defensively immaculate through the whole game. I think it was really one of the best, got to be one of the best defensive performances we've seen through the whole Conte era at Spurs. To shackle City like that is amazing.
It is so much easier to defend well and to play on the break football if you want to, if you get the first goal. Sitting there waiting to concede it just makes it impossible against decent teams. A special word here, I thought Højbjerg was superb, and Dyer has had his best game, should say, for a long, long time. I think it would be remiss of this podcast, having quite rightly given Emerson Royal his fair share of the clog about performance at right back. It's a contradiction, isn't it? Jack Grealish was, I think, City's best player, but he was also up against a player who was having his best game for Spurs. He was really, really good, Tim. I mean, to the point where Pedro Porro must have thought, how am I going to get in this team?
Yeah, exactly. It was remarkable. It's an amazing turnaround for him. It's easy to forget he was being booed on the pitch a couple of weeks ago, and then he was pretty much getting a standing ovation on his own in injury time when he planted yet another perfect tackle on Grealish. And you could see that his teammates were really happy for him. They were sort of celebrating with him. And he sort of epitomised the aggression, which I thought was key in defence and attack, really. Spurs set traps for City. They let them have the ball in soft areas and then aggressively pressed when they advanced towards the box. And he epitomised that, particularly with his work on Grealish. And he could certainly teach the guy to the left of him a thing or two about controlled aggression, because...
Oh, come on now. Don't bring us down on this day of
days. No, because I just thought it was a really interesting sort of contrast between a guy who should know better and a guy who hasn't really seemed to know what he's doing for most of the season. And yeah, Romero needs to learn a lesson from that, because that was the only... You know, it was lucky it wasn't earlier in the game, and it easily could have been, you know, the way that he was playing. And this could have happened many times in the last few weeks, to be honest. So you just hope he learns that lesson.
To contradict or to push back, as they say in the modern past, I wonder whether Romero's performance is what Spurs needed. Two things about that. You've got to have a bit of devil in your team. I also wonder whether the first foul, which people said, oh, why would he do that? Why is he so far up the pitch and all the rest of it? I wondered whether it diminished Haaland's interest in the game. It was such an obvious old-school reducer. Now, look, I'm not approving of the tactic, trust me, but I wonder whether it changed the Spurs' defence. The whole team thought, OK, we're not going to worry about Haaland then, are we? He's going to do that, is he? And it also is worth saying very quickly, Yes, he deserved to be sent off. He hung his leg out. Grealish also found his leg. And people moaning about Grealish getting fouled. He also committed the most fouls in the game. He's a very infuriating footballer.
I know that everybody thinks that Romero is incredibly hot-headed and rash, and he kind of loses control on the pitch. But there's an alternative theory of Romero, which is that he is an incredibly ice-cold risk-taker. He's like a kind of bungee jumper, I guess. Or he's someone who, he's able to, and willing to take risks that nobody else would want to take. And yet his sense of timing and judgment is so good that he almost always gets away with it. Like, I don't think it's a coincidence that this was only the first time he's been sent off in a Premier League game for Tottenham. Obviously, it would have been easier for Tottenham if he was on the pitch the last 5 minutes, but it wasn't, in the context of the game, making that second bookable foul, which got him sent off. Maybe that was still the right decision. I think he placed the game on the edge so much. Sometimes I watch him play and I think, what on earth are you doing? That's nuts. And sometimes I watch him play and I think, he's actually in complete control. He just does things that nobody else would do. So it's not quite the same as saying that he's crazy. I think he's actually incredibly ice cold and cool and clever. He just gives the appearance of being crazy, which is probably a lot more effective. Sometimes I watch him and I think he's actually completely rational. He's just unconventional.
Some of the things he did in the game were amazing. Some of the interceptions were just amazing.
On a yellow card, he was basically perfect until that one at the end, which maybe he had to make. There was a moment about 5 minutes before his second yellow where Grealish was running towards him. You know, Grealish was looking quite dangerous at this point. And Romero basically gets down on his knees and kind of headbutts Grealish in the side, then goes down clutching his head, and it was obviously a foul, but Romero wasn't punished for it. And Grealish is laughing with frustration because he knows that how clever Romero has been there. I just thought it was a brilliant little piece of defending. I mean, it's kind of quite close to us in the press box, so we got a good view of what was going on. But then we know how ice cold he can be. Like, remember the World Cup final? This is a guy who was basically absolutely perfect in a World Cup final against Kylian Mbappe. So yes, sometimes I think he's not as mad
as
he
is. His Instagram
looks.
Was interesting last evening where he said, great performance and everything. And of course, I haven't had a red card for a while. So he was kind of taking the mickey out of himself. James, I'll leave it to you on the Romero.
I would agree with Jack on that second yellow card. Like, I think he had to make that foul. Because if Grealish has gone beyond him, I think City have got like a sort of 3-on-2. And I just think, like, if you ran that equation in your head now, Danny, would you rather, it's a free kick in that position, quite far out. I mean, City, I don't think really have like an elite, you know, they've not got like a sort of elite free kick taker. And there's no one there who you'd think scores every time from that position. Would you rather have that free kick and 10 men or the 3-on-2 with 88 minutes gone, potential equaliser, and then the momentum shift? I mean, I don't know. Which way would you
go? Well, I'm ashamed of myself because I should have been living in the moment. Instead, my brain was going, ask me again when Harvey Barnes is bearing down on Spurs in a week's time.
Romero will be suspended, so who cares? It's Sanchez.
That's my
problem.
Point. It'll be Davinson Sanchez, won't it? Coming out to meet him. But he was part of what turned out to be a fantastic victory. Let me just ask you all, how important the victory was in keeping Spurs in genuine and not just theoretical contention for that Champions League place?
No, yeah, of course. But it has been quietly heading this way in the last few weeks. Apart from, I know you can say ifs, buts and maybes and take out this game and whatever to skew your narrative. But you've got to say that apart from the City and Arsenal games back-to-back recently, they had kept 4 clean sheets and won 4 games, and this is now the 5th one that they've kept in the past sort of month or so. So the defence has been tightening up. Scoring goals hasn't been a problem really all season long. So yeah, it does feel like they're generating a bit of momentum, and injured players are coming back, and 2 good new signings. And yeah, I'm pretty optimistic that they can give it
it's
a really good go.
It's the new Eccleshare on the firm. You've replaced Eccleshare in every possible way now.
No, but to be fair, I remember saying this a few weeks ago, that there are little things on the horizon that are potentially coming to bear here, and it does kind of feel that way. They just need to keep it going for the next couple of weeks.
Newcastle have scored 2 goals in 5 league games, by the way, and we sort of touched on this last week. They've drawn 4 of the last 5. I mean, they're not, you know, and one of those games is away to Arsenal. That's obviously a very good result. Fine, they're not in great form, and their games coming up. I mean, Bournemouth away, fine, they'll probably win that. Liverpool at home, Man City away, Tim Spears Wolves at home, reinvigorated Forest away. Manchester United at home. I mean, that's their next, what, six league?
No, no, and in the same way that the home game against Arsenal loomed very large in the run-in, the visit to St James's Park for Spurs now starts to loom quite large in it. Well, let's get through the other fixtures first, Danny. Let's live our lives rather than plan them. Jack, they are now back in the race for the Champions League place, which I wasn't sure they were going to be even 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's really remarkable how much the mood has changed in the last, you know, from these three wins in a row in all competitions, three clean sheets in a row, plus the signing of Pedro Porro, which I think is relevant to the mood. And I want to take you back to after the 1-0 win at Craven Cottage. In the press conference afterwards, Antonio Conte kept saying, this has to be a starting point. He said about five times. That's the kind of thing that managers often say in press conferences, just to send a message to the players or the fans or the board or whatever. And sometimes it's, you know, not followed up on. And yet that was 2 weeks ago. And in those 2 weeks, it does feel like that was a starting point. It does feel like Tottenham are in the process of turning their season around.
Listen, the game was fantastic. Great performance by Spurs. Lessons about how to play that way and all the rest of it. But we have to move on, because I need to devote a large chunk of this podcast to Harry Kane. Obviously, and you know, typically, that was his first touch with his feet in the game. The record-breaking goal was the first touch he'd had with either feet in the match. And in it went, albeit. And, you know, for someone who gets so many well-struck goals, for it to be a scuffler was even fun in its own way. I'll start by talking about his progression. We'll get on to what we all remember, the best goals and things like that, a little later. Because this has not been, if you think about Alan Shearer getting a hat-trick as a teenager in the Premier League, if you think about Wayne Rooney smashing that ball past David Seaman, I'll say those words again because I enjoyed it so much, smashing that ball past David Seaman before he'd done his GCSEs, they were ready-made superstars. The two people who still remain above Kane in the Premier League goal-scoring charts. Not so Harry. And, you know, the producer has reminded me that before he came to Spurs, he was at Ridgeway Rovers. Then he was at Arsenal. They love that, don't they? I love it too. All the better. They could still have had him. Ridgeway Rovers again, then Watford. And he's joined Spurs and he's in the youth teams between 2004-2009. And then there's the loan years. I'll ask you, as the person who most like to have seen him about that time, James, when did we all know that this was, you know, Orient, Millwall, Norwich, Leicester? Do we have any clue that we had something special on our hands?
I mean, I know there are people who watch a lot of academy football who say that you could tell he was a decent centre forward, but I think even those people acknowledge that it has been a bit of a surprise that he's become Tottenham's record scorer and will become, assuming he doesn't move abroad imminently, the Premier League record scorer. The first time I remember seeing him play was the second leg of the Europa League qualifier against Hearts, which I think was 2011. And I don't know if you remember the game, Danny. So Spurs had won the first leg 5-0 away, and Redknapp made loads of changes for the second leg, as you would. So he was one of like a group of young players who played in that game. Like Ryan Fredericks played in that game. Tom Carroll played in that game. Yeah, so it was like a lot of young players playing in that game. And Kane won and then missed a penalty, or had a penalty saved, a dreadful penalty. Which, when you consider his penalty record subsequently, what happened at the World Cup aside, is quite amusing. And I don't remember walking away from that game thinking that he or any of those other young players were going to be troubling the first team imminently or ever. And to be honest, and I mean, I don't want to speak for other people, but my feeling was, you know, he scored a few goals at the end of the 13-14 under Tim Sherwood, like coming in at the end of the season in the last few games where they sort of had a bit of a bounce at the end of the season. He scored against, was it Sunderland, West Brom, Fulham, I think. But even then, I think people were still sort of thinking he was like a sort of cult figure. Like he would be like Spurs' Shola Ameobi or something like that. That was my sense. And that's certainly how I felt. And I think that's kind of how other people felt about it as well. He looked sort of a bit ungainly, a bit awkward. He was obviously like a decent player. You know, people wouldn't want someone who was utterly shit in the team. But it was still like a fun thing to have like an academy centre forward who scored a few goals against these crap Premier League teams in the side. It wasn't like, that there wasn't a sense that he was going to score 200 Premier League goals at that point. No.
Well, it's amazing how we have our own memories these days, but we also have our social media footprint to check out what we were thinking. Mine, I was very much of the opinion that he was going to be a good player, but I suspect that was, and because I checked my social media footprint at the time, was because I had it in for Emmanuel Adebayo to such an extent that I would have accepted you, James, coming out of the reserves to play up front for Spurs. It's easy to hype players when they're scoring goals in the junior teams. The last time I remember it actually happening where something good came out of it was a long time ago when a man called Mark Falco was scoring a lot of goals for Spurs' lower teams. He got into the team and he got a goal every two games for Spurs once he got in the team without ever being a genius. Jack, the last word on this for you, because if you weren't a Spurs fan, I guess this was all a kind of mad surprise when this chap suddenly emerged.
Yeah, so I think we mentioned this fairly recently on the podcast. I went through some old tweets to find out when I first saw Kane. And I'm pretty sure the first time that I watched Harry Kane was it would have been an FA Cup fourth round game. Millwall 1, Southampton 1 at the Den on the 28th of January 2012. So this is now 11 years ago. And I think Kane missed a good chance, but the best, if I go through my old tweets, Harry Kane of hashtag Spurs stabs over from a yard out at the far post from a corner, hashtag Millwall the best side, hashtag Feeney the best player, hashtag FA Cup. That's a tweet from the 28th of January 2012. And yeah, I remember seeing him at, I watched a bit of him, I think he played the England under 19s that summer, which I watched a bit of. That was on TV rather than in the flesh. I definitely saw him a few times playing for Norwich City the following season on loan. And I thought he looked talented. Because he was always very talented, Kane. And even the start of his back in the academy and in that phase before he made it, people always said of him, he's got very good technique and he's a clever player, but they just weren't really sure he could cut it physically. But no, I would be lying if I said at that point I thought he would be the greatest English player of his generation. And frankly, anyone else, even people who were impressed with him at Millwall or Leyton Orient with his mentality or his goals or his attitude or whatever, I think if they say that they knew he was going to be the player that he has become, that's a lie.
I remember having a conversation when he was in and around the under-21s for England. They're almost exact contemporaries. I remember saying that, well, that boy Bamford, he's got all the skills. Let's be honest. He really knows how to roll a player and he's flicking the ball around. It's fantastic. And Patrick Bamford is still actually a very, very good footballer, isn't he?
Bollocks. Sorry, no.
You're not
no,
having
no.
that.
I watched Leeds yesterday and honestly, he's had an injury, right? He's only just come back. Fine. I watched Patrick Bamford play up front for Leeds yesterday and my thought was genuinely, and I didn't know we were going to mention this on the podcast, that he looked like a League One striker playing in the Premier League. Not to say that to be cruel, but like there's
what, to me or Patrick?
Leagues, but both. The leagues between the two of them. In every
yes, sense. There are now, but they weren't then. That's the point I'm making. There is now. One of the things that, and we'll talk about his development, one of the things that has brought to my attention, if I'm fair, and I said this, you know, one of the reasons I find it so hard that he's broken the original Spurs records, it requires you to get 25-plus goals every year for 10 years, and yet that, despite his occasional bouts of ankle injuries, is what he's done. And this is probably a one-off, but if you look at the leading goal scorers in the Premier League last season, I'll read out the top seven to you here. Mohamed Salah, Son Heung-min, Cristiano Ronaldo, Sadio Mane, Kevin De Bruyne, Diogo Jota, and Harry Kane. He's the only one who's in the top 10 this season. And so the pressures of the Premier League, the turnover of players going to other leagues, all those things come into play. But he's there year after year after year, blatting these balls into the net, Tim.
The minimum he scored in one season is 24 in all competitions, which, yes, says a lot about his sort of fitness and how he's looked after himself. But I think also how he's adapted to different managers, how he's followed instructions, worked with new teammates, adapted to new teammates. I mean, it's interesting to think where they would have been without his goals every season. I was wondering the other day who they might have signed. They definitely would have signed Danny Ings at some point, like without fail, I think. maybe Shane Long as well. It is ridiculous, that metronomic sort of consistency. And it all comes from his attitude. I remember speaking to Kenny Jackett about him when Kenny Jackett was Wolves manager. And, you know, Kenny's like a proper football man, as they say, but he really is. And he's had like a 25-year managerial career. And mostly in the lower leagues, and yet he says Harry Kane's the hardest working player he's ever seen in his 25 years, and that's the secret to it. Or albeit there is no secret, you know, he always had. I remember him saying he was always very good technically, and you know, he could score goals, and he had two good feet and a terrific touch. But you know, he's seen far more talented players, as we all have, really, go absolutely nowhere. if they have a bad attitude or not that personal drive to succeed. And that's behind everything, really, including even in the past few months, you know, since the World Cup, how he's just brushed that off nonchalantly. And I've not even noticed a single difference in him since the World Cup, which is remarkable, really. Just yet another example of that fantastic personal drive to succeed.
Just on a side note, I wonder whether that is something to do with the way the rest of his life is organized. He just seems to have no personal, look, I can't see into his heart or his brain, but because he's married his childhood sweetheart, goes walking dogs, I know this is a public image and all the rest of it, but it appears to me he has no personal psychodrama going on in the background. So he can, and I'm sure he separates his family life from the football, in the football world, he can concentrate 100% on it, because everything else appears to be, with perhaps the exception of not being able to go to Manchester City. Given the game yesterday, why would he want to play for Manchester City? He said rather snootily.
He's completely impervious to like the kind of conditions, though, isn't he? Like, he always plays to the same level. And you mentioned that start of last season where, you know, he wasn't in the team, he wasn't playing quite as well, but that was probably as much as anything else down to not being fit, because he hadn't had a proper pre-season after the Euros. So that probably would have been the reason that he started last season slowly. And even then, he ended up with 17 Premier League goals or whatever it was. And as Tim said, at least 24 goals in all competitions. So, you know, even then, he's kind of made up for it over the course of the campaign. But that is the most impressive thing for me about Harry Kane, is that whatever state the team is in, whatever the kind of mental state of all the other players, what's going on with the manager, how the fans are feeling, like how good the team actually is, he kind of will turn out more or less the same level of performance regardless and score goals at more or less the same rate. I mean, it's just completely ludicrous.
On that, firstly, yeah, Kane was not anywhere near his peak fitness at the start of last season, but every single Spurs player got a lot less fit under Mourinho. Spurs fitness levels as a team collapsed over the course of the Mourinho era, so that's certainly not unique to Kane. I think that's exactly right. What James says, he's got an amazing, I don't know if it's blinkers or his ability to shut things out, but the way that he remains cool and efficient on the pitch the whole time is, I think it's one of the things that's so impressive about him. But I wonder if it's also one of the things that maybe explains why neutrals don't take to him so much, because he doesn't really, I think we like players who play with their heart on their sleeves, like that kind of Rooney. Kane isn't like that at all. Like, I've never ever seen him lose his temper on the pitch. He got sent off once in his career, which I think was when he was at Millwall, which was for two yellows. Even at Spurs, I mean, there was that one tackle on Andy Robertson that maybe he could have got sent off for. But he never loses his temper. There's never any kind of red mist. He never seems to get too down on himself, even when things are difficult. He always retains this kind of, like, ice-cool mental consistency all the way through every game and every season. And I think that's kind of connected to the fact that he's just not a big celebrity figure, you know. He's never been on the front page of the newspapers for anything. I don't think there is any hidden side to Harry Kane or hidden secrets. He is what he looks like. He's just a incredibly professional, hardworking, committed footballer. Who, you know, he has his family life and his interests away from football, but there's not a lot that, you know, he's never going to be a sort of Rooney, Gerrard, Beckham style super celeb.
Let's compare him directly to someone he played against yesterday, Jack Grealish. People fucking love Jack
They
Grealish.
Do, they adore him.
People love, and he's always in the front of the papers for good or for bad reasons. I mean, this isn't just about, like, aesthetics, but, like, he is a celebrity, isn't he?
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. $50, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, welcome back to the second part of today's edition of The View from the Lane. James Moore, Jack Pitbrook and Tim Spears are joining me, Danny Kelly. We're very glad to have you along for the ride as well. As we continue to praise Harry Kane and his extraordinary ascension to 267 goals. And this is no ordinary club record to beat. This was already one of the highest anywhere in British football. Let's for a moment try and take a view about how he's done it somewhat. He's not a player blessed with blistering pace, not a traditional number nine or a target man. He's played at a time when the role of strikers has changed very much. So what category of striker does Kane fall into, and can he even be considered a true striker as he's the playmaker half the time as well? To answer all these tactical conundrums surrounding Harry Kane, we've enlisted the help of The Athletic's tactics guru, Liam Tharm.
From a tactical perspective, Harry Kane is a really good case study for how players can evolve, adapt and change their game in terms of how a team's style evolves under different managers and when managers change in order to continue to perform, and particularly as a number nine. Of course, we associate him as almost more of a number 10 in recent times. I know he wears the number 10 on the back of his shirt. And last season, he had the second highest number of through balls completed in the Premier League. Now, that is in a time where through balls across Europe are on sort of a steady decline. We've got quite used to seeing, quite synonymously really, him dropping deep to play through ball for Son Heung-min. They, of course, have the most lucrative goal scorer assistant partnership in Premier League history. And across the time of them playing together, it's sort of trended from Son assisting Kane to more Kane assisting Son now. But if we delve a tiny bit back further into his history under Pochettino, I think the seeds were really being sown a long time ago. Kane started off really as a box presence. His first seven Premier League goals were all one-touch finishes in the penalty area close to goal. And quite impressively, we've seen him evolve over time. When he first started playing under Pochettino at Spurs, they were very much playing a 4-2-3-1 with Kane at the front and often a number 10 in behind him. Very much Dele Alli a lot of the time, where they'd play combinations or Alli would look to find Harry Kane with through balls. But over time, Spurs got better. They averaged higher possession as they got to a Champions League final, of course, and second in the Premier League. And Pochettino started to introduce a 3-4-3 shape, which had sort of two number 10s behind Kane. Often it was Alli and Eriksen, and also had wing-backs, so Danny Rose or Ben Davis on the left and Kyle Walker on the right. And these would provide Kane with a high volume of crosses or sort of slipped passes through balls on the angle. And he started to score more goals from out wide or in the half spaces. Of course, people might remember his goal was against Stoke and against Arsenal, where he whips them into the far corner from really wide on the left. And he's had to evolve further sort of in recent time. Under Jose Mourinho in particular, they played in obviously much more of a transitional system where that Kane and Son partnership really blossomed. In the 2020-21 season, Harry Kane had 14 assists. Now, in his six Premier League seasons before that, he'd had 18 across all of those campaigns, which is quite a remarkable feat. And I think many people remember the quote from Jose where he says, I will make you explode under me. And he certainly did that. So seeing his creative side have always been, I think, really, really impressive. And now we've almost seen him revert more to that number nine box forward under Conte, where Spurs have maybe been a bit less expansive. He's done an awful lot more of set pieces, often being that back post presence. Of course, Spurs bring in Gianni Vio as a set piece coach and being one of the best set piece teams in the league. But also now they're tending to cross a lot more as a result of going behind more in games. So I think Kane's ability to be almost a game state forward to a degree, that he can score a wide variety of goals. He can be that player on the counter-attack in transition to score that goal to seal a game. But now he can also be that one to, you know, get a header from nowhere, off a cross and really haul Spurs back into a match. So the evolution of Harry Kane for me is undoubtedly the reason why he's in that exclusive club now with Wayne Rooney and with Alan Shearer.
Yeah, Liam Tharm there with a view of how Harry Kane has done what he's done. I mean, I think we need mostly, I suspect, for the rest of this podcast, just warm our hands on the glow of Harry Kane's goals and achievements. James, you know, as the other Spurs fan on the firm here, I'll start off with you. Personal memories or favourite goals, and we'll all have a go at this. What are your favourite memories and goals of Harry Kane?
Picking a favourite goal is quite difficult, really. I mean, I because the kind of contrarian in me wants to pick a slightly left field one, but I would say the best two on a sort of emotional slash technical level, combining those two things, were the first one against Chelsea in January 2015, which I think is kind of the first one of those many where he's cut inside from the left and pulled it into the near bottom corner. I think he scored quite a lot of those in those kind of two or three years. Although that's probably from longer range than most of the others. And the second one would be another very obvious one, the Arsenal one in 2016, where Dele Alli's won the ball right on the corner flag and he's kind of hit the shot in off the post with a mask from a ludicrous angle. Another one, which I think you're going to mention, is Southampton away in, I reckon that was probably sort of November 2015. I mean, he's made Virgil van Dijk look like an absolute mug. He hasn't scored many goals, Harry Kane, where he's beat players, but he's picked the ball up sort of 40, 50 yards out and gone past two players, absolutely surged past Van Dijk and slotted the ball past Gadonija. Those would be the three in terms of like sort of technical quality. I don't know, there have been so many goals. Like Harry Kane's goals have just been like a sort of, they've given such a nice feeling of kind of consistency in my life.
Oh.
Just like it's the only thing you can really rely on. There's not a lot you can rely on in life, is there? But
you know
Harry Kane is going to score most weekends. So it's quite nice. It like kind of gives your life that little bit of structure, doesn't it? The feeling that Harry Kane is going to score a goal.
Let me ask you a question, because we talked earlier on about how he perhaps doesn't suit the modern media image of a footballer. He's not Jack Grealish, in other words. He's never going to be on Love Island, is he? Do you love him, James?
Yeah, I think I do. But for that reason, I think, like, because the last, you know, a lot of bad stuff has happened in the world in the last 5 or 6 years. And I mean, in the world generally, but also in my life. And it is quite nice to have that sense that Spurs might win the football match at the weekend and Harry Kane will probably score. Like, it's quite a nice thing to fall back on over a prolonged period of time. So, yeah, I would say I do love Harry Kane.
So the first thing that stands out to me about the record is just the size of the number. Like 267 is a huge number of goals. Like we've, in the last sort of 10 years, we've seen quite a few players break records for their, you know, for the other big clubs. But Frank Lampard's got 211 for Chelsea. Thierry Henry has 228 for Arsenal. Wayne Rooney has 253 for Manchester United. And Sergio Aguero has 260 for Manchester City. And Kane is obviously ahead of all of those. I imagine he'll probably, where do we think he'll finish this season? Around 280-ish? Assuming he sticks around for next season, he will surely get well beyond 300. You know, this is not something that we see in modern football at all, really. Players, I literally can't come up with another example, so please write in if you've got one. But a player in modern game scoring, apart from Messi at Barcelona, and I imagine Cristiano Ronaldo at Real Madrid, for a player to score 300 plus goals for a team, certainly for an English team, it's just not something that happens. So yeah, he has been a real constant in my life as, you know, someone who's covered Spurs for the entirety of Kane's career. In terms of goals that stand out, so I'm trying to judge these on both the quality of the goal and the importance of the goal. Number one, I'd have the goal that James mentioned at Arsenal at home, March 2016, whipping it in from the left-hand side with his right foot. One, it was a brilliant finish. Also, I hate to say this, but at that moment, it felt like Tottenham were going to win the league. And then obviously they drew the game 2-1 and they didn't. But at that That was the loudest I've ever heard White Hart Lane celebrate a goal. So that's number one. Number two is the header against Arsenal, February 2015, which won that game 2-1, which was really marking out, Pochettino's Tottenham are for real now. A huge noise for that one. Brilliant piece of play to kind of get up, head the ball back beyond the Arsenal goalkeeper. Number three, this is more an important goal than a sort of brilliant goal. Dortmund away, March 2019. Spurs obviously won the first leg 3-0, but they got absolutely battered by Dortmund in the first half of the second leg. I think Vertonghen had to clear off the line about three times. And Kane then killed the game, but he ran onto a pass from Moussa Sissoko, sent the keeper the wrong way with the eyes, basically, and buried it. Tottenham into the Champions League quarterfinals. I think because the Ajax and Manchester City games were so spectacular in that run, people kind of forget how big it was that they beat Dortmund, 4-0 on aggregate over two legs in the last 16. So I'd have that. And then for brilliance rather than importance, I'd have Leicester away 2019, kind of falling over, hits the ball into the ground over Kasper Schmeichel. That kind of unique instep whip finish against Crystal Palace under Mourinho during COVID 2021 at home. Nobody got to see it in the ground, sadly, which was a tragedy because it was an incredible goal. So yeah, that's five. I could do this all day, but I think we'll stop at five.
Tim, you'll probably find yourself having to repeat some of these goals. What has been the things have stood out about Kane on the pitch for you?
I don't say this very often, but I did enjoy listening to James talk a few minutes ago about his love of Kane, and I can relate to that in my sort of footballing fandom. And James is going to groan when I bring this guy's name up because I talk about him all the time. But Steve Ball was like a very similar sort of hero for Wolves fans. He scored 306 goals in 561 games, and it was the same thing. You knew he was going to score every week, and every time I get a new girlfriend, they have to learn those numbers. That's just a prerequisite.
Yes, I think the phrase, every time I get a new girlfriend and they have to learn those numbers, are linked
That's why it doesn't last, yeah. But there is a parallel with Bully in that a theme throughout his career was that, he's too good for Wolves. When's he going to leave? Because he could obviously play at a high level. And that's something you hear, every single transfer window and ever more about Harry Kane. I mean, ultimately, Bully didn't move, and he didn't regret it because he is Mr. Wolves and will always be the greatest footballer.
A fantastic player.
In the eyes of thousands of people.
Of course, I saw all his goals. A fantastic player.
It's a bit different with Kane because, Bully couldn't have won a lot of trophies in the career, even if he's moved on, I don't think. But Kane could have won it all. And I find his relationship with supporters quite interesting. I was speaking to fans before the Arsenal game specifically about Kane. And there's a real recurring theme that his dalliance with Man City didn't weaken that bond. In fact, the general consensus was kind of like, okay, if he goes, he deserves it and he's earned it, and Spurs haven't done enough to keep him, and Spurs don't deserve him for what he's done, which I found really surprising to hear from quite a few people, not just one or two. But the theme again was that they'll always love and adore him for what he does, and if he does go, c'est la vie, they'll move on. I thought that was just quite an interesting dynamic, really, that I guess they feel that Spurs haven't matched or done enough to match Kane's achievements, basically.
On that point, I think it's worth, and this is, I think I'm stealing something that James said to me the other week, so apologies, James. Daniel Levy has been incredibly lucky to have owned Tottenham at a point that Harry Kane came through the Tottenham Academy, because Tottenham have had a, £150 million player for free. That has made the process of trying to turn Tottenham on a budget into, let's say the sixth biggest budget in the country, whatever it is, into a consistently competitive team, has made it much easier. If you get an all-time great player for free, then suddenly running a football club is a bit easier.
No, look, he's basically bailed Levy out like every other weekend, right? I mean, and I think that sentiment that people have made to Tim is entirely fair and accurate, that Harry Kane has done the hell of a lot for Spurs. 260, however many goals it is? Seven?
Eight, seven.
Whatever. Seven, thanks. That'll be 260.
Oh, it will be, and you'll be happy, and it'll all be lovely.
I'll be, yeah. They haven't ever, or very rarely, had they built a team sort of befitting a player who is arguably the greatest player the club has ever seen. And yeah, I you can see why fans would feel, that Harry Kane had been let down rather than Harry Kane would be letting Spurs down by leaving.
But on the other hand, given what Tim said, how forgiving Spurs fans were when he wanted to move, I'm forever grateful for Daniel Levy for digging his heels in Because I think it must have been tempting to take, you know, Manchester City's money.
Well, he wouldn't have to, but would he have dug his heels in if they'd offered 150 million quid though, rather than?
Well, that didn't happen. So, you know, yes, if they offered 300 million, he would have taken the money, but they didn't, and he didn't flinch. And I think there's more chance now that Kane will stay than he will go.
We've talked a lot about how Spurs' failure, one of Spurs' big strategic failures in the last 5 years has been not selling players. I think Kane is the exception to that rule. Kane is the one player who they would never have been better off by selling, because unlike lots of other players, he has remained that good and that important throughout. And if they did sell him, they would automatically become worse. They would never be able to replace him with anyone half as good.
I mean, I'm not going to choose individual goals. I judge football teams and footballers by what they do in two situations. When they're a goal down and what they do away from home. I honestly believe that most of us, with 62,000 people roaring us on, could do a decent job in the home games. The split of Harry Kane's goals suggests another part of his character and his genius, and I'm using that word. 135 of these goals that he's got for Spurs at home. Well done, Harry. He scored 131, so almost exactly 50% away from home, where nobody is telling you how great you are, where everybody wants you to fail and fall flat on your face. He just keeps going and going and going, and Spurs are often... He's been in some decent Spurs teams, particularly under Pochettino. But he was in a Spurs team that didn't win a game for a year away from home. Yet he kept scoring. And the fact that he gives them a hope, an outlet, to use James's word, a certainty, even away from home. But it's easier to pad out these wonderful stats of all the great players we talked about from other clubs by smashing the fourth, fifth and sixth at home against Oxford. Doing it away from home, incredible. Let me ask you a question about the end of the game. He did the interview with, I think, Jeff Shreves for Sky, and then he did the interview on the pitch with Paul Coit. And tell me, Tim and Jack, you were both there, if I'm clutching at straws here, but when he rather bashfully said, well, you know, thanks, that's great and it's wonderful, I've got plenty of time left in me and many more to come. Now, given how careful he is with the media, I took that in my madness as a sign that he might well sign another contract at Spurs.
I don't know. I didn't.
I'm overreading that. Yeah, I'm overreading that.
Crazy.
Yeah.
You know, he would have done a lot of interviews. I thought he spoke really well. I thought he was clearly a bit overcome by emotion, as you would be at that moment. For me, the most. I thought Spurs handled that stuff really well. It's kind of hard to put on that sort of thing at short notice.
They were lucky he was at home. They were lucky they'd beaten one of the best teams and all that. Yeah,
big game. Yeah, they won. Imagine if he'd scored and they'd lost 4-1. You know, it would have been different. I thought it was perfectly done. The interview that Paul Coit did with him on the pitch was excellent. But for me, the standout moment, which I found incredibly moving, was a video message from Danny Greaves, Jimmy's son, at the end of about how much Jimmy respected Harry Kane and how proud Jimmy was of holding this Tottenham record, but how if anyone was going to beat it, he would have been delighted that it was Kane that did it. I mean, I found it very moving. I'm sure lots of other fans did as well. I'm sure Kane did as well.
He did. He really did. I think like his teammates were trying to jump on him and celebrate with him, and he like moved 5 yards away so that he could stop, put himself in front of the screen and just take it all in and really listen to what Danny was saying. And yeah, it's hard to tell from 50 yards away, but it definitely seemed like he was a bit emotional about that. And you're right, Jack. It was perfectly done, the whole thing.
I hope they make that that little video clip available on YouTube. We'll put it on social media, because it would be nice for fans who weren't at the game to be able to see that message from Danny Greaves.
I guess this is an appropriate place for me to do what I want to do here. I've got a microphone. I'm on a podcast. So I want to say something about what the passing of the torch from Jimmy Greaves to Harry Kane as the record goal scorer for the club has meant. And I'm one of, lots of people, I'm not 100 years of age, who saw both players play. And on Twitter last night, people of a certain vintage, we were having this discussion about obviously how blessed we've been to see both players. But to have, I'm not going to say arguably, to have the two best English strikers of post-war vintage and who probably of all time playing for long periods at the same club It's been an extraordinary thing. And I want to add to it a completely personal, and it is totally personal, mad fairy tale as well in this. And it's something about the memory of football fans and how it goes through us personally. The history of these clubs goes through it. We are all conduits for the history of the club and our own background. About 100 years ago, Jimmy Greaves' grandparents made the journey from Ireland to East London. And in 1986, Greaves talked about this, and I've spoken about it to him subsequently. He said he feels actually no connection with Ireland. How could he ever play for Ireland, although he was qualified under the grandmother rule, because he was born in the East End of London. But there he was. These people came on the boat over to London, and their grandson turned out to be a genius and played for Tottenham Hotspur. 50 years later, another boat brought my parents over from Ireland, and I stood as a 14-year-old, watching the last three seasons of Jimmy Greaves at Spurs from down the front, where they still pass the younger people down to the front of the terraces at White Hart Lane. And I watched Jimmy Greaves, and I became obsessed with him, and I loved him. And after he left Spurs with his 266 goals, and I did all right at school, and I knew certain things. I knew you had to pay your taxes. I knew that Everest was always going to be the highest mountain in the world. And I knew that Jimmy Greaves' record of 266 goals would never be surpassed. And over the years, I watched some brilliant forwards at Spurs. Martin Chivers, Gary Lineker, Clive Allen, Jurgen Klinsmann, Jermaine Defoe, Dimitar Berbatov, Teddy Sheringham, Robbie Keane. And I knew that none of them, for different reasons, some of them were only there for a couple of seasons, they were never going to get near 266 goals for Spurs. It was an immovable sun in my world. But what I didn't know, possibly a plane had come from the town of Tuam in Galway in Ireland 50 years after my parents came, and that their son, Harry Kane, again in East London, was going to turn out to be the next genius that would come along. And for Harry Kane to break the record has been, I've watched him head towards it over the last 5 years with a mixture of awe and disbelief, because I'm delighted that one of the things that I took to be the actual proof of a living and active God, Jimmy Greaves' record, has been broken. And now I think that his record will never, ever be broken, unless somewhere in a bar in Kilkenny or Dublin or Ennisfree, two people are looking at each other with a glint in their eye across that bar, and maybe the next one will come as well. It's been an extraordinary journey, and I love him. I love him to death. Well done, Harry. And Danny Greaves' appearance on that screen, I wasn't in the stadium, brought tears to my eyes. It's bringing tears to my eyes now. All right, that's that. And if you're not already an Athletic subscriber, as I always say, sign up now to read all the excellent Spurs coverage as well as everything else on the site. I want to thank Jack and James and Tim for celebrating Harry Kane and the excellent win against Manchester City with me. I repeat to you all then, just go to theathletic.com/SpursPod. Sign up right now for $1.99 a month for the first 12 months. That's theathletic.com/SpursPod. Thanks for listening. Some of us will be back later in the week. You've been listening to The View from the Lane.
The Athletic.